Please welcome to our program. We've been talking about him all morning. This is very interesting. Dr. Robert Foster is a scientist, one of Canada's and the world's foremost pharmaceutical scientists. Last winter, he was in the media discussing a drug that treats lupus, and his company now has created a drug that could be groundbreaking as a potential treatment for lung injury due to COVID-19. Welcome to our program, Dr. Robert Foster. Dr. Foster, always great to have another medical person on the show beside myself. I don't know if my brother told you, but I'm also a Google doctor, but that's for another time. How are you, sir?
Very well. How are you?
Look at you. So my brother says you're the guy. You live in Edmonton, but also in New Jersey. So in normal times, where would we find you today?
Let's see. My left leg might be in Edmonton, my right leg in New Jersey, because I straddle. It seems I straddle both locations. I split my time, actually, between Edmonton and New Jersey, where the offices are. But apart from that, I would say, most of my time I'm strapped to some kind of a plane. But
okay.
Not these days. I'm pretty much trapped.
Yeah, have you been in Jersey over the past few months, or just stayed right away?
No, I've been in Edmonton for, since March. Last I was there, it was in March before all hell broke loose here.
So I'm just looking at some of the background. You know, you're not only a business person, a scientist, and a business person, which is, usually the medical profession are the best in business. But I'm curious about, when you bring a drug to market, most people have no idea how long those things take. And the reason I bring that up is because here we have this pandemic. And before we get to some of the prepared questions, I'm just curious what's your opinion of getting a vaccine for COVID-19 to market, and what we're hearing in the news and the media in the States. What's realistic?
That's a great question. I know that south of the border, if we watch, CNN or whatever, we'll hear statements made that before the election, there will be a vaccine available. I would bet money that that's not even possible. It's going to be really, really tough to get a vaccine that quickly. I think maybe in 2021, there could be a vaccine available. But clearly, I think with the FDA and certainly with Health Canada and other regulatory agencies, first and foremost, they care about safety. And then beyond that, if they're convinced that the vaccine is safe, then they'll be looking at efficacy. So that's the first major hurdle. But the second major hurdle, which is not insignificant, is the whole idea of manufacturing vaccines. And if you think about it, may need billions of doses. And so I know manufacturing facilities are probably jammed right now trying to keep up with everything that's going on, because not just the vaccine, but everything related to drugs around that, there's quite a delay at the manufacturing.
And considering that timeline, anti-maskers, those people who think this is a conspiracy, the reaction has been overblown. We don't need to be taking the measures we are. What do you say to those people? Because you often hear that, and then people like you, obviously, who are equipped with knowledge that most of us aren't. What do you say to that? Given that vaccine timeline, what should we, what we're doing, is that what we should be doing, especially in Canada?
Yeah. Well, the anti-maskers, I just don't get it. It's a head scratcher. Because everybody knows now, and the recommendations have been out there for some time about social distancing and washing your hands and wearing a mask. That's just common sense. But what strikes me about the anti-maskers is that there's a lot of, it seems to me, and this is just, obviously my opinion, but it seems to me that there's a lot of selfishness going on here. And when we talk about herd immunity, we should also talk about masses, the people that are out there. And to me, it's like, wow, if you're an anti-masker, you're thinking about yourself. You're not thinking about your fellow human being. And it's a very selfish way of thinking, I think. So I think that it goes without saying we have to wear those masks.
Now, Dr. Foster, to be clear, you're not working on a vaccine. You're working on a treatment. What's the difference? And in your opinion, what's more important?
Well, I'm not sure I would call one versus the other more important, but I might be leaning a bit more towards a treatment. So the difference, first off, with a vaccine versus a treatment is a vaccine has to be given before you get infected with the virus. So once you've been infected with the virus, it's too late for vaccines that are typically designed to be prophylactic or preventative. There are therapeutic vaccines, but that's another issue altogether. So for people that have the viral infection, and this would even include asymptomatic patients, if you really want to stomp out what's going on with this virus, you do need a treatment. You need an antiviral drug to be able to deal with this. I don't think there's any other way, because to get what we keep calling herd immunity, you probably need to vaccinate a huge part of the population. And if people aren't willing to wear masks, I'm not sure what the numbers are when it comes to people not willing to get a vaccine. I mean, maybe 50%. It's not good enough. It's just not good enough.
So you're saying, like, even if there was a vaccine, a lot of people, this whole conspiracy about the cabal and how Bill Gates is trying to, inoculate the entire world. So even if we get a vaccine, there's going to be some people that won't get it. So we're going to be walking around being vaccinated, and there'll still be some percentage of the population that'll be susceptible to the virus.
Absolutely. I don't think there's any two ways about it. And, even with the flu vaccine, if you go year to year with the flu vaccine, there's a lot of people out there that won't get it, or refuse to get it, or don't even think about it or whatever. And so that further complicates it. If you have, let's say, I don't know what's going to happen this fall or in the winter, but people that don't get the flu vaccine and, don't take the precautions necessary around COVID, we could be in for a bit of a, nasty time this fall.
You know, Doctor, another thing we were talking about earlier in the show today, it's, when we're talking about COVID, it's like, okay, you get it and you recover, or you get it and you die. But there's a big space in between as well, right? Like, this can cause irreparable damage. And I don't think people talk enough about that. I mean, you can get it and survive, but it can be with you for the rest of your life, like respiratory, lungs, correct?
Yeah, and I guess, it's pretty early because, coronavirus 2, the one that causes COVID-19, is fairly recent, so we don't really know the longer term outcomes. But from what we can gather so far, this virus locks on to certain receptors in the body. One of the receptors that is talked about is something called ACE2, and those receptors are all over the body. Predominantly we're seeing them in the lungs, which is why you get the lung infection. But we're seeing those same receptors along, throughout the gut, and on the kidneys and on the heart and all over the place. And the more I read about this receptor, the more I realize they're everywhere. Maybe not in the brain, but you are getting a lot of organs that are being damaged. I don't know what the long-term consequences are, but, from my point of view, who's somebody who also looks at lung function and lung injury, it seems reasonable to think that if you scar the lung, if you think about it, if you scar anywhere in your body, even on your skin, ultimately you lose some of that function. It's just almost like seeing a really nasty scar across your, skin. But you basically get that same process going on inside the lungs. And so how do you reverse that? I guess once you get that damage to the tissue, how do you reverse it, or can it be reversed? And then what happens, 5, 10, 20 years later?
So to be clear, the drug you're developing now, and we'll get into this lupus drug that you've been working on for a quarter century, but the drug you're developing now, CRV-431, it is about reducing the amount of virus in the body and a potential treatment for the lung injury that people get once they've had COVID-19.
Yeah, it's an interesting drug that we have our hands on. one that we've developed ourselves, but we went to the literature and we looked at similar types of drugs over the years, even the previous drug that I developed. And what we found is, for example, the University of Pennsylvania wrote an interesting article, and they showed that they screened something like more than 3,000 drugs. And these are often drugs that can be even on the market. But they narrowed the field down to like just a handful, like half a dozen or so. And lo and behold, one of those drugs just is very similar to our drug. So we started doing some testing, and we tested two different things. We tested the antiviral properties against this coronavirus, but we also tested lung injury in animal models. And we saw a beneficial effect on both instances, both problems. So we saw the reduction of the viral load, or the amount of virus that's in the cells. And this is just basically, looking at testing in a test tube or a petri dish. And then when we looked at the animal models, we saw a whole bunch of reduction of things called cytokines. And I don't know if you've ever heard that word being used, bounced around, but some of these news.
I don't know what my brother told you about this show, but we're mostly doing fart humor, so you don't really throw around cytokines.
Well, there's something called cytokine storm, and so when people wind up in the ICU, for example, oftentimes it's because of something called a cytokine storm, and this is where your body just has a complete meltdown. When it comes to all these things that can happen to it.
Wow.
And you need to reduce all that, and we can actually seem to do that.
Well, what's your timeline for that drug that you're talking about that you've developed? Have you done that in the past 3 or 4 months, or was it a variation of a drug that was being developed previous? It seems pretty quick.
Yeah, actually, we've been working on this particular molecule, if you can believe it, from about 2007.
Wow.
Until now. It just so happens that in some of the work that we were doing on liver disease, we thought we'd take a look at this also in COVID when this, the pandemic reared its ugly head back in March or so. We started looking at it. And so this is a fairly recent development, but the molecule itself has been something we've been working on for a few years.
Go ahead, Howard.
I was going to say, I know that there's some of the stuff you want to talk about as the lupus drug and such, but I want to talk to you as a guy of science. Did you think this virus, because it caught the rest of us by surprise because we're ninnies, but for people like you, when you first heard about this, whenever you heard about it, were you kind of like, oh yeah, that makes sense. This was bound to happen?
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought. In fact, believe it or not, we tested this molecule on coronavirus back in 2015. Mm-hmm. So five years ago. But this is a different version of coronavirus we tested. This is back with the NIH, 5 or 6 years ago. But yeah, these viruses come in different sizes and shapes and different forms. And that's partly because they mutate. Mm-hmm. And so as they mutate, things can happen. And we've already seen mutations on this particular virus that make it more infectious. So recently, I was looking at some articles, like if you look into New York Times and whatnot, they'll show that this, one of the recent mutations, you can get about 10 times the infectious material that you have with the original coronavirus too.
That, like last week, the president, made the big announcement about plasma. Obviously that, I guess, going to market, going to be available. Where do you sit with your drug, like be it Canada or the United States? When are we going to hear the president talk about it? Or will he?
Well, I guess it depends on what happens in November.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So what we'd like to do is we'd like to push this drug. We call it CRV-431. I'll just call it CRV because otherwise it's a big mouthful. But we'll see what happens with CRV. But I'd like to push it into what we call phase 2 clinical trials sooner rather than later. But in order to do that, we need to make sure we do all the proper paperwork to get it in front of the FDA and Health Canada. But we'll start with the FDA. We'll get the paperwork done and get into phase 2. And if we can show some efficacy in a phase 2 study, we can pivot over to a phase 3, which is larger,
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about the development of pharmacological solutions is not an inexpensive or easy road. You know, the drug that I want to make sure I get, is it voclosporin?
Voclosporin, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which recently passed third round clinical trials, and you're looking for FDA approval. But Dr. Robert, you've been working on this. It's cost millions of dollars over the course of 25 years. And when you started out working on it, you had to like mortgage your house to get the money to do the research. So when you hear about, you know, drug companies making all this money, there's a big investment that starts way, way before we hear about it. Maybe talk a little bit about that to give us some context about what the normal course of vaccine and therapeutics, what the development really is.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I was going to say it's a million-dollar question, but it's a multi-billion-dollar question.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I would say, you know, the average numbers that you hear being bounced around out there is $2.5 billion to develop one drug from basically from the bench, lab bench, over to the patient bedside. And it will often take more than 10 years. And in the case of voclosporin, you know, I discovered that drug in about 1995, and it's going in front of the FDA for a final review on January 22nd of 2021.
I mean, wow.
If you do the math there, it's crazy.
We can't do math. That's why we do this.
Yeah, so it took a long time, but that's a little bit of an exception. Normally, drugs don't take that long to develop, but we had a few fits and starts along the way, but eventually it'll get approved. But it's a long process, and in my case, where I started the company back in 1993, that's developing voclosporin, I had to do everything. I had to sort of beg, borrow, and steal to get the funds to be able to do this.
And then when you do that, you really don't know what the end result is going to be necessarily.
No, in my case, that was a good thing, because I think if I had known, it's almost like lemmings, you know, going over a cliff to some extent. I mean, mm-hmm. I didn't actually see the cliff in front of me, so I just kept running.
Wait a second. You developed this drug. It started in 1993?
Yeah, I started the company in June 16, 1993, and then I started working on the drug, and then it became the drug, you know, about 1995. And then it's just been slogging away ever since.
You know, it's funny because you developed that drug in the same year that the last time the Leafs had a chance to get to the finals. Isn't that right, Fred? Isn't 93 the year you Leaf fans keep talking about?
Well, that was a big year, yes, Howard. Yeah. They had a chance after that, but 93 was the big one.
It's too bad that Dr. Robert wasn't working on, like, developing a defense or a vaccination for getting scored on all the time.
I'd be helping the Oilers out if I could do that.
Yes, of course.
So, Doctor, you're in Canada and you're in New Jersey. What is the difference between, you know, Canada and the United States with a drug like that? Is there stark differences, or do they tend to be on the same page? Because I know sometimes drugs are allowed in the States and not in Canada, and vice versa. How does that all work?
Yeah. So from a regulatory standpoint, where you're dealing with the FDA in the U.S. or Health Canada here in Canada, those are pretty similar. There's a lot of what they call harmonization between countries, so that the regulatory approach is fairly similar. The big difference, however, is access to capital, you know, so mm-hmm. cash. You know, when I was starting Isotechnica or Aurinia in its early days, back in the 90s, I was literally going to Bank of Montreal and any bank that would let me in their front door to see if I could find some cash to be able to move this drug program forward. But as you can imagine, it just took so much money. So I quickly had to think about going public and take the company public. In the U.S., on the other hand, there's so much more access to capital and infrastructure that it's, at least now in my experience, it's much easier to get the cash. Maybe it's mm-hmm. also, you know, I know a lot about what I'm doing.
I don't want to put you on the spot here, but, you know, there's a lot of talk in the news, the President Trump talking about, you know, if he's reelected, he'll reduce the cost of prescription medicine in the States. I'm not really sure what the question is, but maybe it's just as simple as, you know, we have a certain price point for drugs here in Canada, And there, it's sometimes 80 or 90% more. Why is that?
Well, a lot of the drugs that we have in Canada are also generic versions, which are less expensive versions. So that's probably one of the key differences. But we have to. That's sort of a little bit of a tightrope walk that we're walking when we talk about drug pricing, because at the same time you want innovation, and the only way you can get innovation is to offer companies good patent protection. So if automatically you take that away after a certain number of years, and you aren't allowing exclusivity, then yeah, your drug prices will come down, but your innovation will also come down. So if we want access to, let's say, cutting edge medication, you need to think about protecting patents. You also need to be thinking about drug pricing. I mean, there's always that good balance between almost like giving away the drug on the one hand versus, making people bleed for drug prices, which I don't think is fair.
Again, I don't want to put you on the spot. I wasn't part of the pre-planned questions, but I thought it had to be asked because it's fair,
Fair, yeah.
Freddie, we got about 90 seconds left with Dr. Robert Foster. I'm not sure what we're going to do in terms of... If we don't clear up all these questions, maybe we'll hold you over for a couple minutes after our break. But what do you want to say at the end here?
Me?
Yes, sir. Do you have any final thoughts for Dr. Foster, or should we just hold
him
over?
No. And again, you don't have a crystal ball. You're not a predictor. Everybody's talking about a second wave this fall. Do we still have a lot ahead of us? Is this going to get worse before it gets better? And what do you see over the next year?
Yeah, it's that's a really good question, too. And I'm pretty sure nobody's got the answer to that. But when I look at the numbers globally, I'll put it out globally, I don't see the numbers going down. I see them flattening out, or mm-hmm. at least the rate at which the new patients are coming in. I see that fairly constant. So the numbers have really flattened, but there's, once in a while they are going down. But that's...
Everybody has to, keep the masks on, social distance, use your head, and see where it takes us.
Exactly. Not thinking about ourselves so much, but thinking about the people all around us.
You know what we'll do? We'll just go to our break about a minute later. So if you're waiting for the traffic in Hamilton, just hang on 1 second. Just my final thing is, we talked about this the other day, Freddie, about, the difference between this and a lot of other things. That human beings, there was an end to World War II, there was an end to, 9/11, there was a point where the all clear was sounded. We talk about the new normal. Do you see a time when we will be back to some kind of normal? When might that be?
I actually do. Because viruses, and this is no exception, this virus, but all viruses, they want to protect their own living headquarters or space, which is us, the host. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to kill off the host because they in doing that, they kill off themselves. Mm. So eventually, I think they'll start petering out because they want to survive. So the coronavirus causes probably, a third of the common colds. So I think this virus can go the same way. It could eventually start, fizzling out with mutations that make it a little bit less dangerous. That's not to say it's going to be less infectious. Mm-hmm. But if you do get infected, it's probably going to be a little bit less dangerous. That'll take time.
Well, I hope you enjoyed your time with us. We certainly did. Very interesting stuff, Dr. Robert Foster. And I hope this won't be the last time that we can, because you could become like our Dr. Fauci. We could go to you for science questions, and you might do some briefings from time to time. I don't know what your schedule is, but we would love to have you back. If people want more information about what you're up to and your company, how do they do that?
Well, I think they could go to our website, because that's probably got the latest and greatest. The current company I'm the CEO of right now is called Hepion Pharmaceuticals. Hepion Pharmaceuticals.
All right. Well, listen, my friend, thank you very much.
Thanks, Doc.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
All right, kids, we'll take a quick break here. It's Humble and Fred Radio, and we'll be right back.